Hello, and welcome to the State of Our Workforce. My name is Michelle Wilson, and I am the Director of Evaluation and Learning at the National Fund for Workforce Solutions. Each month on State of Our Workforce, we take a journey into the heart of workforce innovation and explore how to build an equitable workforce. In this episode, we're digging into a powerful shift that's gaining momentum across industries, skills-based hiring. For too long, traditional hiring practices have relied on degrees as a proxy for talent, reinforcing occupational segregation and shutting out millions of capable workers. But what if we reimagine hiring to focus on what people can do, not just where or if they went to school? Joining me today is Audrey Mikael, Senior Vice President of Private Sector and Membership Experience at Opportunity at Work. Together, we'll explore how skills-based hiring can create more inclusive pathways, break down systemic barriers, and help employers access a deeper, more diverse talent pool. We'll talk about who stars are and why they matter. We'll discuss some of the changes employers need to make and the systemic barriers we can begin to dismantle when we center skills in hiring and advancement. Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us today on State of Our Workforce. Each month, we take a journey together into the heart of workforce innovation and explore how to build an equitable workforce. And I'm super excited to be joined by Audrey Mikael. Did I pronounce your last name right, Audrey? I thought I did, but I wanted to make sure, obviously. She is the Senior Vice President of Private Sector and Membership Experience at Opportunity at Work. So Audrey's new. We're new. We're just now meeting. So I'm super excited to meet you and the work that you all doing and to dig into that. How are you today, Audrey?
I'm doing really well. Michelle, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be talking to you today.
Yeah. Where are you based, by the way?
I am just outside of Washington, D.C.
Okay. So you're in the D.C. area. Okay. So are you ready to jump in?
I am. Let's do it.
So we are here to talk about the beautiful work that you all are doing around Tear the Paper Ceiling campaign. But before we dig into that, tell me a little bit about your work, Opportunity at Work, and what brought you to the field and what you love about what you're doing right now.
Oh, gosh. Thank you for that question. I spent most of my career working for, so my sort of cocktail party fun fact is that I spent most of my career working for one company. I got there first time by intention right out of school, and then twice more by acquisition. So clearly I needed to go work for a nonprofit if I intended to get away. No, but in all seriousness, it was such a gift. And I think one of the things that work taught me and that I appreciate so much now in the field of workforce is that style points aside, people invested in me, people trained me, and having access to that skill development, getting, you know, feedback regularly, whether harshly or not, is one of the things that has enabled me to do the work that I do now. And I think what I've tried to carry forward is both the memory of what it felt like to get feedback, and leave the harsh parts behind, but keep the investment, keep the intention and the care and the rigor in mind, because this work deserves nothing less.
Right. So the STARS program. So I want you to, for folks who are unfamiliar with STARS, before we dig in too deep, just to do some level setting, talk to us about what it is, how it started briefly, and then we'll get into where it's going and where it's at, why we're so excited about the work that's happening right now.
Well, for those who may not be familiar with Opportunity at Work, it's an organization that is working for and alongside STARS. And those are workers who are skilled through alternative routes. That's what STARS stands for. rather than a bachelor's degree. And essentially, we are working to rewire the labor market so that all workers can learn and earn to their full potential based on their skills. So when we think about our mission, it's really to ensure that we start to reverse some of the effects that stars have experienced in the labor market, particularly in the last few decades. Stars are 70 million workers, fully half of the U.S. labor market. And so it's the juice is worth the squeeze, yeah. is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, for sure. And I think what I appreciate about it so much, when the campaign first launched, it resonated with me in ways that I had been talking and thinking about, because I spent time working in the community college system and with first generation community college students. And the idea that you didn't need a bachelor's degree or higher to get a job. It's a matter of finding out what you want to do and getting the right skills or education in whatever way it shows up to allow that to happen. And that may not be through an academic institution, but however you get there, right? And so what you all are doing with the STARS campaign, the Tear the Paper Ceiling campaign, really resonated me from the jump. So we understand who the folks are in the STARS ecosystem. What are some of the biggest limitations that you see when we kind of talked about around traditional or credential-based hiring practices? I mean, I certainly have my own experiences, but talk to me more about that.
Yeah. You know, I think for so long in, particularly I think in the past few years, and actually I would even say that this sort of mindset, mm-hmm. That we've had to counter really was powerfully took hold in the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing about that is it's, you know, almost an accident. I think there are a number of different factors that have affected the way STARS have experienced the labor market. Mm-hmm. One is the College for All message, which was not a particularly nuanced way of talking about how to achieve mobility in this country, right? And I want to be clear, college is fantastic and great, sure. You know, path to mobility and path to the middle class. The challenge is, of course, that I think we have for too long not thought about how individuals, the varying ways that individuals gain skill. And so one example of that is very commonly we'll be presenting, any one of us might be presenting in a room full of employers, and we'll ask them, you know, raise your hand if you gain the skills you most deploy today in your job through your education, or whether or not you gain those skills doing your job day to day, just showing up. And invariably, Michelle, like most people will raise their hand that they have learned their skills, that they deploy, the things that make them successful are not the things that they studied in school. And so that dissonance between what folks recognize when they think about it and the way sometimes they, and we're starting to see this shift, but the way folks behave when they're hiring look pretty different. And so one example of that is, hiring managers who have a bachelor's degree tend to overestimate the proportion of the workforce that has a bachelor's degree. I spent most of my career in the private sector. I'm in the DC bubble. I will fully raise my hand and say, I am one of those people. Before I entered the world of workforce, I don't think I really realized that we have a math problem. And when you require a bachelor's degree, when particularly when you use it to just screen people out, yes, rather than screening skills in, the challenge there is that you are eliminating from consideration off the bat the majority of so many groups of workers. Mm-hmm. You are eliminating from consideration the majority of Black workers, yeah, the majority of Hispanic workers, the majority of veterans, the majority of rural workers. Mm-hmm. And so the implications of that choice that felt like a hack at the time, perhaps, mm-hmm, or was, as our CEO would say, a problem of cutting and pasting our way to this issue,
yeah,
is one that now has left us with a giant opportunity gap.
So I have an analogy. Tell me, push back on if there's something wrong with my thinking on this, but I often think about, so I don't know if this is still the case, but once upon a time, in order to be, I don't even think they're called bank tellers anymore, but to work in a bank, you had to have a bachelor's degree. And that conferred some sort of trustworthiness, skill level, whole host of other things. But a grocery store clerk, not so much. And my argument is there's customer relations. Varied customer relations in a grocery store that you have to be able to respond to. There's both money handling is involved. Like it's a transactional experience. And I would argue that in a grocery store, you have to have a level of awareness around a whole host of other things without the barrier of protection that you may have, say, in a bank or so. Something. I mean, like, so not to say that one is better than the other, but just in terms of what the value that's placed on two jobs that I think require customer relations skills, money management skills, trustworthy, I mean, similar skills. And again, I don't want to be a reductionist and make it seem like it's that simple, but is that a fair analogy in how I'm thinking around like how barriers get placed on jobs? Is that?
Yeah, no, I think that's quite right. One that we look at a lot is the skill similarity between retail sales and sales rep. And one is a low wage job and one is a middle or high wage job. And I think when you look at the differences in skills, they're almost identical. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we do see folks make those transitions in the labor market from retail sales to sales rep. But one of the opportunities we think exists in the labor market today is simply to pay individuals for their talent, for their skills, and not just for their labor. And I think one of the challenges is, you know, who do we consider labor and who do we consider talent?
Yeah.
And you even see that in the way in which folks are trained and upskilled. Like I talked about my own experience and folks really investing in me and training me to do the work that I definitely would not have known how to do just out of school. Whereas stars are so often, you know, trained for safety and compliance, and you know, there's a real difference in how we treat folks.
So, with the tear the paper ceiling campaign, again, one of we'll talk about the work of that campaign in just a sec. But I saw a stat that said 83% of U.S. employers who have seen the tear the paper ceiling campaign consider hiring stars for more jobs now versus 3 years ago. That's huge. Like, that's big, right?
Oh, it's it's incredible. And on a personal note, Michelle, I come from a research and advisory background. And one of the eye-opening experiences for me in observing the campaign, you know, having spent most of my career in B2B environments, is the power of that very human storytelling. I'd seen research, like so many, had seen that folks, you know, their minds shift when they see data, but their hearts follow when they hear stories. And I think one of the things that Tear the Paper Ceiling campaign has done so well is to not only have that base of quantitative data that, you know, we can talk about that all day, but to remember at the end of the day that these are human beings having human experiences. Again, one of the things that, you know, I've been delighted to talk to folks about over the time that I've been at Opportunity at Work is to hear people connect. Again, this is coming back to the unexamined assumptions people have and the dissonance they experience. But when they connect a star that they care about and the experience that they have had with the fact that they may also be in some way, you know, part of a system that isn't working particularly well for stars. Yeah. You see those light bulbs go off. It's an aha moment. And that's so much of what the campaign has enabled is just like, hey, you haven't thought about this. It's not that you're a bad person, but there are some unexamined assumptions that the campaign surfaces for folks.
So I want to get into that a little bit. So first, let's just talk about the campaign itself and a little bit about how you got to that 83%, right, in terms of engaging folks. Talk to me about that a little bit.
Well, we've had tremendous partnerships. I think one of the things that we're really grateful for in the Tear the Paper Ceiling campaign is the simple fact that we have had not only incredible, evocative, creative that in a partnership with the Ad Council and creative from Ogilvy, but also so many partners like Walmart, like Comcast, who have donated media that has enabled that message to get out in a way that I think has, suffice it to say, exceeded our wildest dreams and expectations. There have been over 7 billion impressions of the campaign, which just means folks have experienced the campaign messaging that many times over, you know, 2.5 years, yeah, which is really tremendous. That alongside, and I do have to point this out because I'm really proud of the campaign. I'm really proud of what that has achieved. But I also have to say, like, there is so much other work happening in the field.
For sure. Yeah.
And that's a beautiful thing to see coming together. So many organizations are part of this movement,
including the National Fund. We're signatory onto the work. Yes. So we're really, yeah.
And we are all chipping away at different parts of this. And the work is hard enough. And you and I chatted about this a little bit. The work is hard enough and there is enough to do that it really does take all of us. And there's room for a lot of things.
Yes. Yeah.
You know?
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
That's one of the things actually, sort of that theme of experimentation. We wrote a case study with an employer called HII in the defense contracting space. They were facing one of the common challenges we see in that space, which is one of responding to RFPs, and those RFPs often have degree requirements. And the irony there is HII was working for the Navy and trying to recruit and hire Navy veterans, but the RFPs that they were responding to were preventing them from doing that. So how do you negotiate with a partner to be able to create that win-win? Mm-hmm. One of the things that organization did such a nice job of is experimenting with different tactics and levers because the need was so great that no one approach was going to solve their talent challenges. And I think that's true for the field writ large.
For sure. So when you think about, so the STARS, clearly you have identified, and what we all know is that there's a talent pool out there that really goes untapped when we have limitations and barriers to people entering the workforce. I am curious about what it actually looks like, the practice for employers to do the skills first approach, like hiring, and particularly in an equitable way, right? I think about that, like what is, and how you guys, like, tell me more about how you guys engage and think about those conversations, or have those conversations with folks, and what it looks like in practice.
Yeah. Well, we alluded to one part of it. And so let me start off by saying, when we think about STARS and we take that very large 70 million number, I'm going to say the most obvious thing in the world and say that STARS are not a monolith.
Sure.
And one of the things that I think, again, you know, when we start to peel back assumptions that people have, one of the things we like to say is that low wage does not equal low skill. Right. And so having entered this space right at the beginning of the pandemic and really just being a sponge, soaking up so much of the activity that was happening in that timeframe, it felt at the time like there was a lot of investment going into upskilling. And that is great. I have, again, like,
that's a upskilling, right? Like, shout out to upskilling, but yes.
Absolutely. And don't we all need upskilling? And I'm trying to upskill, you know, like, yeah. Right. You know, every night and weekend, what haven't I learned that I need to learn?
For sure.
But again, I do think the subtext of that at times has been such that the assumption is that if you're a star, you need upskilling.
Right.
And one of the things that our research points out is that there are over 30 million stars who today have skills for minimum 70% higher wage work. So when we start to think about equity and we think about what are the ways in which we can start to chip away at this problem, one of the easiest, I think, is just recognize, and it's coming back to that retail sales to sales rep transition, that stars have skills and that the knee-jerk reaction, and I don't mean to be disparaging here, but that we should recognize and start to enable folks to understand and to get compensated and be valued for the skills that they bring. And so many of the jobs that folks tend to think of as low skill are in fact just low wage, and we have not valued them sufficiently.
Right.
One of the things that we're finding in our research is, you know, if you take some of the low wage jobs that have been undervalued today and simply boost their earnings, I think that goes a long way to giving stars opportunities for mobility. Mm-hmm. So there are a couple of levers I would point to. One is this notion of really understanding the skills that folks bring to the table. The second is I do think that there are opportunities to increase wages in certain low wage jobs that are frankly undervalued today. The third piece is that, you know, in the work that I do, is I think about the large enterprise space. It's not going to happen all at once, and I'm not by any means suggesting that folks who are going to go from, you know, 0 to 50 miles an hour in this journey overnight, because we do recognize there are real obstacles, there are real transformations organizations need to go on. But one of the things that folks can start to do is simply, and it certainly doesn't stop here, but the indiscriminate use of degree screening is something that every organization can examine, particularly if it's a generic bachelor's degree. Like, is that something that's really helpful? Secondly, there's work for all of us to do, and it's not easy. One of the case studies that we wrote with the state of Louisiana, one of the insights that came out from that team was, understanding the skills that are required to do a job is a skill in itself. And I want to honor that. I don't want to sweep that under the rug, because that team taught us that there's actually work to be done there. Mm-hmm. I've seen folks really start to understand jobs both from a specialist perspective. Like, do you have folks who specialize in writing position descriptions? That tends to be a public sector lever. In other cases, it might be partnering with your learning and development team. It might be interviewing managers about the skills that genuinely predict success in a role, and that two are really needed on day one. And so as we think about the employer perspective of, well, how do I fill my talent needs, to the point I made about HII, it takes some creativity. It takes really chipping away at the problem in a variety of ways. And it takes a genuine change management approach, particularly when we think about hiring managers who, and I say this with great empathy for hiring managers, are in a position of like, they just got to get the work done. It may not be folks who are hiring day in and day out. And so trying to navigate their resistance or their lack of understanding, or frankly, their just day-to-day busyness, all parts of the process. So there's a lot of work to do. And that's just when we're talking about talent acquisition, we haven't even gotten to talent development, performance management, career pathing, and all the rest
right,
of it.
For sure. So when you think about the skills first approach to hiring, and what it looks like, let me back up. One of the things we chatted about prior to starting our podcast today was around I appreciate a lot of things about the work that you all are doing, but particularly how you're able to communicate that this is work that needs to be done across the spectrum, right? Like across the ecosystem. And if we look at it as that and accept it as that, it feels more manageable rather than saying it all has to happen here, or you need to do this, or you need to do that. And that to me is similar to the work, some of the messaging that we had around our career navigation work. Like when you look at career navigation and you understand that it's not a linear path, that people go here, 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 and they interact with so many people across that ecosystem, that everyone plays a role in this piece. If we're talking about supporting people and self-sufficiency and their ability to navigate their own careers rather than having their career navigated for them, right? Like, so how you show up, right? And so I feel like when I hear what you all are doing and when I see what you're doing, that's what I think I really appreciate about the work, is that you're like, but here, if you do this here, this is the change it can make. If you do this here, this is the change it can make. And collectively, you know, it's the impact of that.
I appreciate that, Michelle. And I think that absolutely speaks to our aspiration, particularly in the Tear the Paper Ceiling Coalition, where our hope is to be able to, and the way I think about it in my role is, what are the obstacles that no one organization is going to be able to resolve individually that we can bring together? And, you know, that's not to say that's a one and done thing by any stretch of the imagination, but for a collective action output or outcome to happen, I think we need to be pretty strategic about what are the most immediate set of obstacles that implicate multiple actors in the ecosystem where there is value to coming together, because we've got to align incentives. We've got to find those opportunities to work together. And, you know, sometimes, to be honest, it's no one's job. So how do you make the space for it?
Right, right. So just going back to the career navigation piece, how does that map on to the skills-based hiring, right? And let me just give an example. One of the things, well, I don't know if this is a fair example. I'm thinking about the work that we do at the National Fund. We're in the process of launching our new strategic plan. And one of the things that leadership had great insight around was thinking about, like, here's where we're going. What do you all need to get there? Like, does everyone have the skills to move us in this direction? And if not, what do you need to do that? And to me, that feels, and that was, everyone had to respond to this question. And, you know, not to, you know, shout out the National Fund, but shout out the National Fund is who I work for. But I just thought that was beautiful. I've not been in an organization where we've been that deliberate around making sure everyone has the resources to thrive in their jobs, to do the work that has been laid out in front of them. So those are the kinds of things I think, again, are skill building and where you go from that opens up, I think, for folks, career pathways, because you're now doing something maybe that you aren't doing. So it's not career navigation equals this, but it is a pathway of some sort. And so I'm just curious about how you think about, or what the conversation looks like around career navigation and skills-based hiring, and how you all are talking about that.
So first, let me say, on a personal note, I think there, we've a long way to go, and skills taxonomies are super useful, but there are lots of them. And when we think about individual workers moving between, even if you happen to be in an organization that is fairly sophisticated in its use of a skills taxonomy that's mapped to career pathways, and you get that coaching. Like I talked to someone just today whose job it is, and it's such a gift to the employees in her organization, to coach workers on mobility opportunities within their large enterprise. But it's two folks supporting 120,000 employees.
Oh, wow.
And so that's a pretty impressive fact that it simply exists, that is an employer that cares enough about its workforce that they've made that investment. And yet the magnitude of the challenge is pretty significant. So for employees in that context, that's a lot of room to move. And that's a fairly, sophisticated set of opportunities. And for them, what they told us was they view success as enabling workers not only to move, and you alluded to this, Michelle, up within a well-understood career ladder, but actually understanding that careers are lattices and folks move sideways and diagonally and they take risks and they take stretch assignments. And, you know, careers are not a simple climbing of one ladder for anybody. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's one piece. But then when we think about the opportunity for folks as they move across organizations, and as they not only think about their skill development and their fulfillment of work at work, but also the mobility opportunities that might be available to them if they just had visibility, I think we're in super early stages of that. So that's, in my opinion, the worker view. What I will tell you from a research perspective is, you know, we've built a tool that is freely available online called Starsight.
Yes, let's talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, and so that's a partial response from Opportunity at Work that we've created and share as widely as we can in order to help whoever's interested understand what does it look like for a worker to move from, say, you know, a web developer role to a software developer role, because that is a common transition in the labor market. And what are the skill similarities? So exposing some of that data in a way that is user-friendly, that's not necessarily going to be the all-singing, all-dancing answer, but our chipping away at this very significant problem is to bring together data from multiple sources, make it really visually appealing, make the interface as user-friendly as we could get it, and share it as broadly as we can, not only from an employer perspective or from a workforce organization perspective, to be able to see what is the concentration of stars in any given geography in the country, but also how might we understand how workers are moving from one job to the next, and how might that enable us to think more creatively about career navigation, and indeed from the employer perspective about recruitment and sourcing talent.
So I'm also curious about the demographics of the STAR. Are folks who are having the demographic that's having the most success around being hired in this space? And I ask that question because I think there are a lot of services and programs aimed at younger people, which certainly that's important. But we also think a lot about mid-career professionals, folks who've been out of the workforce for a while, for whatever reason, and they decide to hop back in, or, you know, who's having the most success in this space?
From a demographic category perspective, that is a good question. I don't know that I know the answer to that. What I can tell you on a more anecdote, so our data folks, I'm sure, could give you an accurate data-informed answer. What I can tell you is that where we have seen multiple partners express a lot of interest, and maybe this isn't, again, like mastery of the obvious here, not going to be terribly surprising, but where we see really a lot of renewed interest and excitement is around veterans and youth. You know, and I do think that's, it's probably a factor of the moment that we're
in. Yeah.
But I don't know that I could give you an accurate answer about where is mobility happening, although we do have now a model that enables us to think about that from the perspective of, you know, places. So what are the regions that are experiencing mobility, and where do stars have a greater likelihood? Mm-hmm. Pathways, what are the pathways that drive mobility? And some of those are going to be pretty familiar, but that shifts all the time. And then of course, by population or by groups of folks. So not sure I know that answer.
Yeah, that's fine. I was just curious as you were talking about it. It was just a question like, huh, I wonder. The other thing I want to go back to, again, 83% of US employers who've seen the tear the paper ceiling are like, okay, we get it. A lot of times we say focus on who's willing, not the folks who are not the unwilling. So we're dealing with the willing of the coalition of the willing. But I have to ask, the coalition of the unwilling, are those folks like what do they have reasons? Is there a rationale? They just aren't interested. I mean, obviously you're not going to get 100%, but I'm just curious what the opt-outs are saying.
Yeah. What I've experienced, and again, talking in the realm of anecdote and just my own personal experience, there are a few categories of organizations that have been where we've experienced greater resistance. And you are right. There are plenty of organizations where folks are recognizing the solution that STARS are and the solution to their talent challenges. And so there's plenty of work to do with organizations that fit that category. But in geography, so some categories of places where there's maybe not the sense of urgency might be geographies where there's a less of a concentration of STAR.
Okay.
Is one. There are employers that feel like, you know what, we do not have a recruitment problem. People are knocking down our door. So this is not, they might. And the funny thing about that is sometimes what we'll experience is there may be some interest, mm-hmm. but that interest may not be resilient in the face of obstacles. And so part of the reason we love a coalition of the willing is because there are going to be moments of truth along the way. There are going to be, in many cases, like mundane obstacles. There's a reorg, you're not meeting your number, there's a new leader, there are all kinds of things that slow progress. And if you still need to solve a talent challenge and STARS are a solution to that challenge, you're more likely to overcome that moment of truth than if you're just doing it because you think it's, you know, kind of a nice thing to do.
Hence the 83%, right? Right, because you recognize like this is a solution here. We're being offered a solution.
And the one thing I'll add is that I think, again, going back to the earlier comment about do folks recognize what proportion of the workforce actually possesses a bachelor's degree? It's been very much in the news that we're approaching a demographic cliff, that Gen Z is more skeptical about the value of a bachelor's degree. And so for all of those reasons, I do think that that mindset is likely to be shifting and will continue to shift because if it doesn't, you will have a math problem. And there are plenty of pretty high profile folks saying, you know, you don't need that bachelor's degree. And that, you know, we can, again, debate that. A bachelor's degree is a great way to develop skill. It's just not the only way to develop skill. And it's a great way to demonstrate things like grit and resilience. But
sure,
it's definitely not the only way. And that's one of the things that we hear from employers from time to time as well. I know someone has grit and I know they have resilience and I know they can stick with something if they have a bachelor's degree. And our response to that is just, yeah, but that is that the only way someone can demonstrate that capacity for
it? Well, yeah, I was going to talk about my own experience just in terms of not educational pathways, but there are folks who don't find challenges in college, right? Like because they've been groomed to do academia for so long. And so they understand how to go in and do academia in a way that it does not produce the kind of grit. I don't know. This is just me riffing off of something from my own experience. Like it may not produce what you think it's producing by the fact that you have a degree, right? Or something like that. And I'm not poo-pooing them. I have several of them. I'm not poo-pooing them at all.
You know, I in a former life managed a lot of early and career professionals. Universally, they had if not a graduate degree, a bachelor's degree. And one of the things I experienced is actually were not particularly resilient when it came to revising. So getting feedback and incorporating. And I always wondered, is this because like you write a paper, you turn it in and it's out of your life? Because in the world of work, incorporating feedback, sometimes conflicting feedback, revising is a thing. And it's not always a thing you have to do
in
school.
Right, exactly. So when you, so I think the other thing, one of the other things that I think about when we think of STARS is community messaging, right? Like I'm always curious about that. You mentioned Gen Z, or like, oh, wait a minute, maybe college, who needs to spend all that money and go into debt? And there are other ways like that feel, I mean, that's a Gen Z thing, but I'm thinking about other generations, particularly if you go back further, where in some communities, particularly in Latino communities, Black communities, where your pathway out was through education, at least that's what you thought, or that's what you were told, right? And so we found that in some, doing some of our interviews with young people when we did the career navigation, they were in really successful careers, thriving, living on their own, loving life, but feeling like a failure to some degree because they didn't complete school, right? Because that, you know, that was a narrative. That's been a narrative for so long. So I'm curious if you all, how you think about that, how you engage around that, or if that comes up at all, or if you see.
Yeah, there's no doubt. Yeah. And we have a team of folks who, we have a STARS Advisory Council, we have a STARS Engagement Team, and they're critically important to our mission because the unfortunate truth is, while the campaign has been very successful and very powerful, the force of feeling less than in our culture because you're a star is real. And we have heard a lot of feedback, and it's fairly consistent, the notion of imposter syndrome and the sense of, you know, hearing that message loud and clear that if you haven't completed a bachelor's degree, it's no matter what other pathway you've chosen, somehow it's less than. And that's, I hope, changing, but pervasive. And so I do think that the sense of community, the language of STARS, one of the things that we've heard in our research and through our STARS Advisory Council and through our engagement team is, and I'm grateful for this because it's asset-based, because it is trying to honor what people have rather than define them by what they don't have. But I don't think the job is done by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, I think it's one of the things that I think we just have to keep pushing on is even something simple like when an employer says degree not required, or, you know, degree or equivalent skill. The way that reads for a STAR is often, well, you're gonna take a degreed candidate. So what we've really tried to encourage from the employer perspective is to genuinely seek STARS. I mean, I think that's the essence of what we're trying to do as an organization, is to create demand for STARS talent and to hopefully, by extension, help STARS recognize their value and enable them to be seen in a different way than perhaps they have traditionally been seen.
So, I mean, I was going to ask you a question about what gives you hope, but I feel like you've talked a lot about it, but feel free to add more if you like, but I'm really curious about next steps and where are you in this process? Like, what's next on the immediate next steps on the horizon for you and this, for you all in this work?
So I'll start with awareness building. That work continues. As much as we've been delighted and gratified by the way in which the messaging has started to reach folks, we're not done. The next phase of the Tear the Paper Ceiling campaign will focus more on skills. And where the first phase of the campaign really told the story of STARS, now we get to dig in a little bit deeper and talk about skills that workers have. So that's on the awareness building side. We continue to pursue that work. But what I'm really excited about, and frankly, the reason I joined Opportunity at Work, where you know my training and my heart lies, is driving employer practice change. And that's not, again, that's a slow and incremental.
Right.
But I'm here for sure. It. You know, like every employer that we talk to that has a great story to tell, that has insights to share. I mean, this is what I'm so energized by. And we have written a bunch of case studies. We have a bunch more that are in the queue that are in development, but there's incredible work happening. And I think one of the things that that does is not only teach people, all right, well, you know, Microsoft did this and State of Colorado did that, but actually normalize the set of changes and make it somewhat, if you will, unsafe to stand still. So eventually those employers who are like, well, everyone's trying to knock on my door, are also going to recognize that it will hurt their employment brand, their employer value proposition to be not particularly progressive, shall we say, in the arena of skills. I think ultimately that helps all workers. I think the opportunity that we are driving towards is a more equitable labor market for all workers.
Mm-hmm. And lastly, so do you have an example, before we go, do you have an example or a shout out to a company that you think is really illustrative of the Tear the Paper Ceiling campaign and working with STARS? Is there a story that's just like this, I got to tell this story?
Yeah, I'd love to tell the story of Train Technologies. And they have a leader who's been an incredible champion, Amy Volz. She is their head of workforce innovation. And what a cool title and what a cool job to have.
Shout out.
When it is, you know, to the point that we were talking about earlier of sometimes this hard work is hard to do in part because it's no one's job. Well, it is Amy's job to do workforce innovation. And one of the things that I find so incredible and exciting about Train is they aren't really looking, not just like accepting STARS, not just removing degree requirements and hoping for the best, but actually actively looking to recruit STARS into their company. They, again, you know, there's not one lever that works across the board, but one of the things that that we talked about and actually wrote a case study on was Train's apprenticeship program for their HVAC technician role. And the level of, I think the thing I want to highlight for folks is conventional wisdom would have you believe that an apprenticeship, particularly a registered apprenticeship, which this one is just so hard to do. And the counterintuitive insight from Train is that they actually had a lot of the building blocks all in place. And so much of what Train was able to do, they did very quickly. They did with partnership and support. And they found that once they looked around, they actually had a lot to build upon. And so I think the inspiration there for other employers is to talk to your L&D folks, and you're probably further along than you think. And there's more that you can build on, again, in the interest of recognizing it's hard work, but we're going to take it step by step and do the work incrementally and see results over time. Train, even in a way, even in a lever that felt hard. And for some folks, they're like, oh, I don't know. I don't know if we have the wherewithal for that. What this particular example showed us was actually you're maybe closer than you think.
Right. I feel like that's a whole other conversation when you mentioned the building blocks, because I would want to, we could have a whole other discussion. Like, what are those building blocks? Obviously, we are running out of time, but there's so much more work to be done, and we look forward to seeing what you all are doing. Obviously, at the National Fund, we like to talk to our partners in this space. There's a lot for everyone to do, so it's really critical. We felt it was really necessary to have the conversation with you all to lift up what you all are doing, because it's so important to the field, and obviously, there are lessons that we can draw down from that in our work, particularly in working with our national partners as they work to create equitable outcomes in their community. So thank you for spending some time with us this afternoon. Any last thoughts?
Yeah, I think the last thought I'd want to leave you with, first of all, this work happens in partnership and it happens collectively. The second thing is just the hopefulness. I think what we found in the research that we released last week on April 24th is that while we saw stars lose access to jobs between 2000 and 2020 to the tune of almost 7.5 million jobs.
Wow.
And that's a really, I think that galvanizes us. That
yes.
The good news is that starting in 2020, we've begun to arrest that trend. To the tune of over 750,000 of those jobs coming back and that access and opportunity being opened up again. We think that we can get to 10 million more great jobs for stars by 2030, and it takes us all. Mm-hmm. But there are, again, multiple levers to get there. And so I think the final word from me, or the last thought I would leave folks with, is we now, I think, have much more clarity and vision about what that path to those 10 million jobs can look like, where they could exist, what are the pathways, who are the populations that can be affected. And so while we launched this research last week, we are just getting started and starting to bring that insight into contexts that are meaningful for our partners and for employers that we work with is really what the work that we want to continue moving forward.
A fantastic last word, last words. Thank you, Audrey, for joining us today. To stay tuned, we appreciate you tuning in. We know you could be anywhere else in the world, but you decided to be here with us, and we appreciate it. Have a great day.
State of Our Workforce is a production of the National Fund for Workforce Solutions. This episode was produced by Josh Enoch. The music in this episode is produced by Alex Productions. You can find past episodes of State of Our Workforce on our website at www.nationalfund.org. To stay updated on State of Our Workforce and all things workforce development, be sure to follow the National Fund for Workforce Solutions on LinkedIn. Don't forget to subscribe to our State of Our Workforce wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. We appreciate you tuning in and look forward to bringing you more valuable conversations in the future. Remember, everybody, life is tricky, so stay in your magic.